Hey, hop in, man.
Hey, man, who's Carr?
You know Wooderson?
Oh. How's it going, man?
Hey. Pretty good. How's it going with you?
Say, man, you got a joint?
No, not on me, man.
It'd be a lot cooler if you did. All right.
Yes, Matthew McConaughey's career was launched in 1993 with that high school comedy, Dazed and Confused. That was the soundtrack band called War with Lowrider. And McConaughey became huge when he took the lead in the John Grisham adaptation, Time to Kill. Around 2010, there occurred what's known as the McConaissance. He quit the forgettable rom-coms and he took on meatier roles, most memorably Ron Woodruff in Dallas Buyers Club, for which he won an Oscar. Most recently, he is starring in Guy Ritchie's The Gentleman. He's also written not a traditional memoir, he says. It's called Green Lights. It's a mix of personal philosophy and anecdote based on diaries he's kept for years.
36 years, I always had a diary on me. I mean, I didn't write in it every day. Some days I wrote in it all day. And then I would go, sometimes I'd go a few weeks without writing it. You know, when I look back at the diaries, I noticed that early on, like everyone, when do you go to a diary? When things aren't going so great, you know, when you're trying to figure shit out. And then I noticed in my early 20s, when I was starting to have some success with my relationships and I was enjoying college and and things were going well and I maybe just found my new career, that I wasn't writing in it as much. But I was like, oh, you know what? You might want to write in it now when things are rolling and you are catching green lights, McConaughey. So when the red lights come later and things, you're lost again, you can go back and say, what were you doing when you were successful? So that's when I started to write in it more almost every single day, if things were going well or if they were going not so well.
Do you know what? I never realized that you consciously and deliberately went cold turkey on the rom-coms.
Yeah. But if you think back, did you notice that you didn't know where the hell I was, right?
Well, do you know what? The first time I ever really noticed you was in Dallas Buyers Club. I mean, really noticed you.
Right.
Because you were so damn thin.
Yeah.
I mean, method acting, right? How did you lose so much weight as a matter of interest?
That was kind of easy. It just, that was militant. One, I gave myself 5 months to do it. So I didn't do one of these, you have 5 weeks to lose, 50 pounds deals. I didn't do that. I gave myself 5 months. I ate three egg whites in the morning, one cup of tea, 5 ounces of fish and a cup of vegetables for lunch, 5 ounces of fish and a cup of vegetables for dinner, as much wine as I wanted to drink at night, zero exercise, and you lose 2.5 pounds a week like clockwork.
Right. Children, don't try this at home. Did you do the same thing for True Detective? Because Rustin Cole's pretty thin.
You know, I didn't do that. Remember, the True Detective came after Dallas Buyers.
Yeah.
So True Detective is me at around 170. And I was 135 for Dallas Buyers Club. So that's me probably 5-6 months after slowly gaining weight and holding there at 170 for Rustin Cole.
I was going to suggest to you that that was possibly the most fun you'd ever had with Woody Harrelson, but it's a pretty dark series, so I don't know whether you would describe it as fun. What do you think?
Well, it was fun because, look, and I remember that this is Woody and I. So Woody and I have done things, obviously, before, mainly comedies. We've done EdTV. We've done Surfer Dude. In our own lives, when we're hanging out together, any time with Woody, it just makes you get younger. It always feels like a Saturday with Woody. And when he and I get going, it's like, where do I start and where does he end and where does he start and I end? And we just add on to each other and kind of roll. So that's how he and I interact. We get on True Detective, and I've made these choices for Rustin Cole as this very stoic man. And the first like week into shooting, Woody's like coming up to me going, dude, what the f-? I'm like, what? And he goes like, the way you and I work, McConaughey, it's like tennis. I hit the ball to you, you hit it back. I hit it to you, you hit it back. We get a volley going. But now I'm hitting you the ball to you and you're just standing there and letting it bounce past you and hit the backstop until it comes to rest. And you're still just staring at me. And he goes, there's nothing funny about that. And I said, I remember telling him, I was like, Woody, I think my hunch is that over time in this relationship in True Detective, that actually might be funny, which in some ways it was. And so it was a whole new way for he and I to work together. And we laugh about it. We got frustrated with each other quite a few times, but we're great friends. So that's all part of it.
Let's stick with the career for a while. Dazed and Confused, you became big. Yep. And then, of course, in Time to Kill, you became huge. And you headed off, according to your book, to the Monastery of Christ in the desert in New Mexico. I mean, you often head off. You head off to the Amazon, you head off to Africa, you head off to the Monastery of Christ in the desert. What's going on there?
Got to recalibrate. Got to go somewhere where memory can catch up with me. Got to go somewhere where my head and my heart and my spirit can start, you know, really communicating more freely. Those are all at times when I've taken these little walkabouts, were times when...
I mean, little walkabouts, let's be clear. You headed off on a solo trip to Peru, or you ended up going into Africa and not knowing where the hell Ali Faka Touré was. You know, I mean, it's not a little jaunt. It's like a punishing expedition.
It is more of an expedition. I thought of it. It is definitely more of a solo expedition. But I've learned that, look, I've taken these trips at times when I felt like I needed to get out. I felt imbalanced. And because I gave a damn, I wanted to know what the hell it was all about and figure out. Look, right after I get famous, the world, the affluence of frequency of options come just bombarding me. Wow. I needed more than 24 hours in a day. Things are going great, but I'm not really feeling my feet on the ground. I'm not sure, you know, I love you. Oh, I love you. I love you. I love you too. Oh, you're so great. Here, do this script. Do this script. Do this script. Do this script. Do this. Whoa, 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 whoa. Wait a minute. 3 days ago, I couldn't do any of these scripts. And now the world's just saying it's one huge green light. Do whatever you want. Wait a minute. I got to go figure out what the hell matters and what doesn't in the world and with me. So how do I do that? You get fame, you have no anonymity anymore. You meet no strangers anymore. So I got to head out to where I can be anonymous. I've always felt my soul, I got to go find some anonymity to be able to listen to myself and to be able to be creative and true to myself. So I take off on these trips. And the reason they're so long is because I've learned that the first about 12 days of these solo trips are a living hell. I do not like my company. I'm not sleeping well. I'm not present. I'm shaking monkeys off my back. I'm not enjoying my own company. But around day 12, seems to be the consistent time for me, I have a breakthrough. I'll have a purge. I'll come through the other side where I've forgiven myself for certain things and for other things that are bugging me. I've said, well, enough is enough with that. We're not doing that anymore. And then I hit a point at day 12, usually morning 13, where I'm like, okay, buddy, you're the one person I can't get rid of, McConaughey, and we're stuck together, buddy. So let's figure out how to get along. And then all of a sudden the trips are great. And then all of a sudden I'm present. Then I'm off on the adventure. Then I'm telling the stories that you read in the book.
Some stories you don't tell, you just refer to in passing. So yeah. I need to ask you about doing peyote in the cage with a mountain lion.
True story. I will say that mountain lion ended up purring in my lap at the end of that.
Well, that's your recollection. Can you be trusted?
I was the only one was there. It was just me and the mountain lion.
You'd have what to were you doing in a cage with a mountain lion?
We were matching frequencies. I was very confident that that I could not necessarily tame this wild mountain lion, but I was very confident that I could get on the same frequency, and that mountain lion was not ravaged for food. So it would not have been smart. I remember thinking, this mountain lion has eaten, so he's not starving. So that's a plus for the idea of getting in there. And then I was on the outside of the cage and for a while, and then the mountain lion came up to the cage and slowly got calm and on my frequency and began to kind of hang out right there next to the cage, like it wanted to be next to me. So I slowly moved and got in and moved very slowly. This all went on for about an hour. My approach was to go in and sit down took over an hour. And then once I was in, I slowly moved, and that he moved to me, and he didn't have any too abrupt movements. And then I just sat down in the corner and slowly let him just take his time to come over me. That took another hour. And then, like I said, it ended up with that mountain lion purring in my lap.
Crikey. It took so long, I imagine he wasn't that well fed by the end of it.
Well, he never took a nip of me.
Where were you?
I was deep south Mexico.
78 stitches sewn into your forehead by a veterinarian. I'm hoping this wasn't the same incident.
No, it wasn't. And I put that line, I've been told, I didn't even think about it, but that line comes right after doing peyote with the mountain lion. And a lot of people have asked that question, like, wait, are those two connected? No, they're not. 78 stitches is South Florida, Navarre Beach, riding jet skis. I fall off. My nephew's riding behind me. Just as my head comes above water, he rides jet ski right over my head, knocks me out. And I remember, next thing I knew, I was knocked out. So next thing I knew, I'm getting kind of carried up out of the water onto the beach. And my dad's on one side, and my nephew's on the other side. And there's a lot of people on the beach staring at me with hands over their mouths going, oh, my God. And I'm like, what? Hey, everybody. Obviously, I was in shock. And I remember my dad hustling and putting me in the car in the passenger seat, and then like very hurriedly getting in the car and pulling out of that parking lot and driving down the highway. And driving down that highway in South Florida, you get these afternoon sort of monsoons. It started to rain really hard, and dad was doing about 85 down the highway. And I was like, Dad, what's the rush? I'm fine. And I remember kept wiping my right eye because I was like, I can't get the water out of my eye. And it was blood. And it was because my right eye, the skin was sagging from the rip cut in my forehead. And I remember reaching up to the vanity mirror to have a look at what I looked like, what it was that had happened to me. And my dad, this arm came from the driver's side and grabbed my arm as I was reaching for the vanity mirror. And he goes, no, son. And my dad, I grew up in the age of, hey, you just rub it. You know what I mean? Hey, it's never as bad as you think it is. Rub it off. And so my dad grabbing my hand, my arm, to not let me look at what happened, that cut in my head in the vanity mirror, that's when I knew it was serious. And I remember all of a sudden, that's when the pain came on. And this big sort of golf ball size knot came up in the back of my neck. And I started crying and it started hurting. And he drove 90 miles an hour and pulled in this little spot right off the highway. And it was pouring down rain. And we ran in. And he goes, sew him up. And the guy goes, who? Your son? He goes, yep, sew him. He goes, but sir, I'm a veterinarian. I've only worked on animals. He goes, I don't care. Sew him up. And damn if that vet didn't sew me up right there. And he did a heck of a job.
Your acting career could have never started. That was before you were in Dazed and Confused.
That was early on.
Consigned yourself to character acting roles for the rest of your life at that point.
Who knows? Another urn scar.
Your father died while you were making Dazed and Confused, and he was a larger-than-life character. And you talk about his rites of passage that he accorded to all three of you boys. Mm-hmm. Describe to me what the rite of passage was for you.
Rite of passage for me, having two older brothers, and part of my dad's version of turning his boys into men was there's a physicality to get to a point, and every young man or son has this in some version, where it's like, when is it you think you can take your old man? Well, none of us ever thought we could take our old man. My oldest brother took my dad up on the challenge much earlier than I did in life. Middle brother never really did. I had my chances earlier on, but definitely wimped out of that idea. And I must say this, those challenges that he would throw up as his rites of passage, like for me, and you read the story in there where I had my chance after the stolen pizza and he got on his knees, he goes, I'll give you four shots to my one, just, you know, across his, with his chin out there. And I did not take him up on it. Like I look back and I go, I think if I would have said, okay, I think what my dad was wanting me to do then was just to give him the first of the four. And I think if I'd have done that, he'd have probably smiled and gone, oh, Dan, that's a pretty good shot, buddy. What do you say we call this a truce? And gave me a hug and that'd have been it. But I didn't. He just wanted me to take the challenge. Anyway, my rite of passage with him came years later. We were walking out of a bar. We'd had a couple beers with friends of his. And as we were walking out of the bar, Dad was behind me. The bouncer stepped in between us and put his hand on my dad's chest as my dad was walking out and said, did you pay the bill, sir? And my dad said, yeah, and kind of kept walking. And as he looked down on this guy's hand, like, and was about to sort of get maybe pissed and say, son, let me tell you, whoever you are, bouncer, don't ever put your hands on me. I remember in slow motion, this hand going on my dad's chest. And the visual of another man's hand on my dad flipped a switch in me. And the next thing I knew, I was getting pulled off of this bouncer who I had knocked about 15, 20 feet back into the bar over a table and had him on the floor. And he was just about coming to unconscious. And I get pulled off and I'm still kicking and screaming. And I hear this voice in my ear. That's enough, son. That's enough. And it was my dad. That was a certain rite of passage for me with him, in the vein that he called all of his friends and saying, hey, the littlest one, me, Matthew, the mama's boy, he's going to be all right. He's going to be okay. The fact that I had taken that risk, that physical risk, and engaged in what was violent, was a rite of passage.
You say all you ever wanted to be was a father. What kind of father will you be when you need to accord rites of passage to your children?
Oh, we have rites of passage now. We still
what
do.
Are they?
I don't have the same kind and the same version that my dad had with us. I just don't, not because I think the way he did it was wrong or the way I'm doing it's more right. I just don't really choose to. You know, we already have expectations, and our children know their expectations. We do have our rules and discipline, and there's consequences for them. There's a we had one the other day. One of them was, you know, had some attitude with their mother, and we had to, you know, stop the whole damn all the fun everyone was having, and sit down and go, you pulled over on the side of the road. And sat there for a long time and said, this will not be tolerated. You cannot do that. It's not only disrespectful to your mother, it's disrespectful to yourself. And we went over the long lineage of why until they understood that, and it will not be accepted. So, you know, as my kids get older, they're 12, 10, 7 now, we'll get older, we'll go forward. Those, you know, I've got where and when will my boys want to challenge me? Where and when will my daughter go through her adolescence and puberty in the teen years? And, you know, in our family, the idea is that I was always raised where you live with your family till you're 18 and then you go off on your own. We'll see how much that happens with our kids. Camilla and I's goal is to raise conscientious, autonomous and confident young men and women, but respect and trust is big. Self-reliance is big. We want them to be able to, you got to know consequences. They have to, because they have to understand how to go negotiate in the world out there, which does have real consequences. And, you know, those are the values, some of the values that we're instilling, but I don't choose to instill them the way that my mom and dad did with me, although, the thing with my family, and they when I was raised, they chose the corporal punishment because they were like, I'm not going to ground you because that's taking up your time, and your time is valuable. And They had a good point. It was always sort of quick, lethal. It hurt. Never got injured, but it hurt. You cried, and it was over. We don't really, Camille and I do raise our kids with that discipline, but I sure understand it.
You and Camilla have been together for an extraordinarily long time for couples in the movie business.
It's
unusual, right?
I don't know. Is it really?
Oh, yes. Come on.
Well, I mean, it was never a fling. I mean, people can have flings and dalliances and go, I don't know. Maybe the marriage, when I met her, it would seem to be the one for me. And we've now got a family, and that's our plan, is to do this for the rest of the life.
I always get worried when I talk to people in your line of business about their successful marriage, because I'm terrified that, you know, next month you're going to say we've agreed to consciously uncouple or some such thing.
I mean, you know, I'm not going to sit here and knock on wood. We go about it day by day and do the best we can. But we got married, and we take the covenant of marriage seriously. We got married because we wanted to. I write about that in the book. You know, we love each other. We're creating a family. We're still growing together. There's a season, as far as I can tell, for being a parent. We're in the parenting season right now. We got a 12, 10, and 7. You know, they'll move on out of the house and go do their things, and then Camille and I'll have another season where it's a little more like, oh, hey, I said, how you doing? You know, we're checking in at 8 a.m. instead of 10 p.m. And that's what happens when you get so busy with kids sometimes. You know, you got to look up, and all of a sudden you go, oh, hey, honey, how are you? haven't checked in with you to all day, and it's 10 o'clock at night. We're finally saying hi. That's just one of the things that we got to work on, too. I think all parents have to work on that.
I'm talking to actor Matthew McConaughey. Australia, foreign exchange for a year when you were, I don't know, still a teenager, and you stayed with a bizarre family called the Dooleys. I'm imagining you changed their name.
You're imagining I changed their name?
Yeah.
It's the Dooleys.
Really?
We're going with the Dooleys.
Did you go a bit crazy in Australia? I mean, you started eating only iceberg lettuce and ketchup and running 6 miles a day and decided to become a monk and wrote manic letters home. Did you go a bit crazy?
I don't know if I went crazy. I don't know. It matters your definition of crazy. I mean, look, in hindsight, if you do the math, look at all the things that I was doing and the practices that I was picking up, and remember, I'm celibate. I decided to be celibate. I was creating resistance. I was creating things to achieve, things to overcome for myself to maintain my sanity. I mean, I think everyone understands that to some sort in different ways in their own lives. Sometimes we have to, when you're kind of lost and trying to find yourself, you need something that's measurable daily that you go, okay, I can rely on that. I achieved that. I overcame that. So that's why I became vegetarian and a half-assed one at that. That's why I started running 6 miles a day. That's why I decided to become celibate. I needed disciplines. I had to create these disciplines, and some of them very odd, in my own life so I could have some measure to my identity. I needed them for identity in a time when I was searching for my identity. Remember, I'm 18, turning 19. In a foreign land with a foreign family, and I'd left. It's very funny, you know, what I'd left. I had just come out of high school where I was just rolling. I'd made straight A's. Mom and Dad were happy. I had a job. I had 50 bucks in my back pocket. I was dating the best-looking girl at my school, one across town. I got my car. It's paid for. I got a 4 handicap at golf. I mean, things are going great. And then all of a sudden, they head over to Australia, and all of those luxuries came to a screeching halt, for sure. And I end that story, which I fully believe, I would not be sitting there talking to you today. I wouldn't have the life I have if I did not have that year in Australia. I was forced inward. If I went crazy, if that's what you want to call it, then call it that. Whatever. I think everyone should go crazy then, to some extent in their life, because it forced me to find myself. It's the loss of identity, the fact that I did feel like maybe I was losing my mind, and I was trying to answer why to everything in the middle of this place on my own, where I had to rely on myself, was an awesome journey for me.
Are you afraid of anything?
That's a good question. Because I'm not that afraid of much. I tell you what I've noticed sort of balances my fear, and I believe in a very healthy way. Like, I am afraid of things. Like that old adage, that sort of no fear, no fear. I don't believe in that. I actually fear a lot of things out of respect for them. But I'm probably less afraid to face a lot of fears that I have, maybe, than some people. It's the overcoming of the fears that I think I've had a sort of real appetite for in my life. I do, you know, the idea of death, people just go, oh, geez, well, let's not talk about that. That's such a, don't bring that up. It's sad. Well, wait a minute. No, it's not. I don't understand that. I think it's better if we don't deny that. Let's look at it in the eye. We're going. It's going to happen. So as I write about in the book, let's not be afraid to put ourselves on that, on that eulogy and say, what would our eulogy be? What the hell are they going to say about us? What story's going to introduce us when we're gone? And don't deny it. Some people just don't like to talk about it because it's like, oh, Jay, don't talk about that. Don't bring up death to the kids. What do you mean? It's going to happen. So why don't we look it in the eye and go, what's it going to look like? What are we doing right now to write that story? And what's it going to look like when we look back? And what's that story going to be that introduces us when we're gone? So am I afraid of death? No, I'm not looking forward to it. I'm not trying to get there any quicker than I do. I don't like pain, you know? So there's a lot of things I fear, but I think I do have an appetite for trying to overcome a lot of fears that I have.
I mean, you seem to be constantly challenging yourself. After those rom-com years, I mean, which you describe as there you were, shirtless on the beach rom-com guy, and you were never much bothered by the constant critical write-offs. And yet, you could have carried on cruising on that. You didn't want to do it. As we've said, you went cold turkey. 20 months, you disappeared. What were you thinking would happen?
Well, as I said, what I wanted to do, roles, dramas that could challenge the vitality of the man that I was becoming now with a newborn son and finding the woman that I loved and wanted to spend the rest of my life with. My life was very vital at the time. And the rom-coms for me just kind of weren't challenging me near to the extent that my life was. And I remember looking in the mirror saying, well, look, dude, if your life's more exciting than your work, good on you. But then I said, but I just want to maybe just try. I want to try to have my work at least challenge the vitality of my life and the man I am in it. So the roles I wanted to do, not offered to you, McConaughey. No one's paying for that. They're not making those offers. So they were not an option. So I did the second best thing, which was process of elimination. Let me stop. If I can't do what I want to do, let me stop doing what I've been doing. And I talked with my money man. I talked with my agent. I talked with Camilla. Shed many a tear over the idea of, oh my gosh, I'm going to go cold turkey, stop, say no to what I've been doing. No to what I've been expected to be doing. No to what pays my rent. And I don't know how long before I'll get a yes to anything else. And I didn't know how long, but I made the pact with those close to me and myself and said, that's it. No. And it took 6 months for Hollywood to get the message. They kept sending rom-coms with astronomical money offers up front that I turned
down. Like what? What did you turn down?
Well, I turned many things down. There's one I tell the story about in the book that came in. It was a rom-com. It was an $8 million offer. And I read it. I was like, no, thank you. And it came back with a $10 million offer. And I said, no, thank you. I came back with a $12.5 million offer. I said, no, thank you. Then they came back with, I think it was $14.5 or $15 million offer. And I said, you know what? Let me read that script again. And I read it again, and it was better written. It was Ooh, it had possibilities. Ooh, maybe I could come off the range and come back and do this one. I mean, this thing is just really a good script. Now, mind you, it was the same exact words as the original script, but at $50 million, it sure read like a better script. But I eventually said no to that. And I think that was part of the straw that really got the signal to Hollywood. You know, I talk early on about Hollywood. You got to want her, not need her. That let Hollywood know, oh, McConaughey's serious. He just turned down a $50 million offer, and this script's pretty damn good. Don't send him any more the rom-coms. He's really not doing them. And so then nothing came in for 8, 9, 10, 12, 14 months. Nothing. Nothing to read, not a whisper, nothing. I didn't talk to my agent once a month, and we just check in and go, nope, nothing. So I kind of, thought about other careers. Maybe this is it. I never thought about going back and doing another rom-com. I really said, hey, you're hanging in there. And I remember this about, I had many moments of this the longer it went on. Around like 18 months in of nothing, I remember thinking like, oh, this is like really good sacrifice. This sacrifice is getting, it's got fangs to it. This is good penance. This is going to work out. I was in now. It was almost like losing the weight for Dallas Buyers Club. I was in. This is, it became almost easier the longer it went in some ways because I was getting some honor and like, yes, I'm really, like the year in Australia. I could have come back, but I gave a handshake that I wasn't. I had plenty of times in Australia where I was like, I got to go home. I was like, no. This is going on long for a reason. You're losing your mind for a reason here, bud. Same thing with this 2-year hiatus. I didn't know how long it was unended. I didn't know how long it was going to be, how long it was going to go. And I was starting to, had to remind myself many times, there's a reason. It's your soul's going to get its residuals. You're going to get return on your investment of taking this penance, McConaughey, this sabbatical from acting in the movies. And sure enough, boom, here came Killer Joe. Here came Magic Mike. Here came Mud. Here came Dallas Buyers. Here came all the run of films that I did over the next 10 years. I became a new good idea because I was gone. I unbranded for 20 months. No one knew, where's McConaughey? He's not on the beach. He's not sure. He's not in a rom-com. He's not in my living room on the TV. Where the hell is he? Well, shit, I don't know where he is. So then they just kind of forgot. Well, when you're kind of forgotten for a while and you're not introducing yourself to the industry and the world as you have been consistently for the years prior, all of a sudden you kind of show up as okay.
So excluding the Dallas Buyers Club, for which you won an Oscar, which are you most proud of since you're what you coined, I think, your reconnaissance?
Reconnaissance. I mean, I don't. They're all children to me. All the movies I've done. I mean, look, I miss True Detective. I miss Sunday nights watching that. I
thought you watched it every Sunday night.
They gave me all of the, obviously I could have watched everything early, but Camilla and I chose to watch it every Sunday night like everyone else. And just, we'd do it week to week and then kind of talk about the episode the following through the week and get ready for next Sunday night to watch it.
I miss True Detective.
Yeah, I do too. That script that Pizzolatto wrote, that Cary Fukunaga directed, was just hot. And then Woody and I, and that, it was just, it felt good doing it. And then to watch it be put together like that was like, oh, wow. I do miss it. But I have, gold. It is very dear to me. Gold is sort of there's a lot of my father in Gold, in that character, Kenny Wells. But I could go on and on about a lot of different roles that I've played.
One of the things you've been doing, you became a professor of practice. Yep. At the university you attended, the University of Texas in Austin, where, as far as I can understand it, for the students, you kind of deconstructed how movies are made.
Yep, that's it. It's called script to screen. So through my 28, 29 years of being an actor, I started to notice about 15 years ago about how different the final product that you put on screen is from the original script. And sometimes it was better. Sometimes it wasn't as good. Sometimes it was just different, but it was always different. And how did it get there? What journey did it take? What major action sequence that you loved when the first script got cut because you didn't have the budget for it, and that's why it's not there? What actor came in but fell out? What small role became a big role? What big role became a small role? What subplots got cut out? Why'd you do reshoots to get to that final picture? So I basically created the class that I wish they would have taught me when I was in film school. So it's called Script to Screen. We pick a film out that I've done. And I started this with Free State of Jones. And we give these 35 serious film students the original script or the original book that inspired the script. They read it. They declare what it is, what movie they would make out of that, what they see as essential themes, et cetera, et cetera. Then we hand them the second script and they discuss the differences. Wait, what happened to this character? Why was this cut? Why was this added, et cetera, et cetera. The third script, fourth script, the final shooting script. And then after the shooting script, we show them the first assembly of the film. And that's very different than the shooting script. And then we show them the final film, which is very different than the first assembly. So it's putting some science behind the magic of movie making. And there shows that there's many different ways to skin a cat. And it takes a bit of that onus off of that original script thinking, I have to direct exactly what this script says word for word, which is a rigid idea. And movie making and creativity as a whole is not a rigid idea. You got to be open to magic and open for things to happen along the way. So that's what the class is.
Did you teach The Evolution of A Time to Kill? Because that would have been a classic. I mean, the evolution of it from the John Grisham novel and the way you talked yourself into the lead.
No, I didn't. I mean, you know, that would not be because Joel Schumacher, who directed that, who actually passed away this year and is no longer with us, I wouldn't be able to speak for him. And it's a filmmaking class. It's a movie making class. So, you know, the stories about how I got the role is a great risky story about how to take a risk that pays off and making it pay off. But it's not as much about how that movie got made and what that original script that Akiva Goldsman wrote became the final movie. So like we just did Guy Ritchie's The Gentleman. Well, that final movie and that original script are like very, very different. You know, guy likes to rewrite it along the way and rewrite on the day and then rewrite in the editing room, et cetera. Well, you compare that to the one we did last semester, which was Mud with Jeff Nichols. And that final movie is about word for word exactly what the original script is. So they're seeing different ways to do it. I would need the director there. So no, we haven't done A Time to Kill.
As a matter of interest, Guy Ritchie's, as you mentioned, The Gentleman, it's been very well received. There is talk of him doing a television series. Are you involved in that?
No, I'm not, but I read that.
Do you want to be involved in it?
I mean, look, Guy and I had a great working relationship, and I like him as a director and a man. So if he's interested in bringing something up with me, I'd definitely listen.
I'm talking to actor Matthew McConaughey, who's just released a memoir called Green Lights. I mean, you've made some duds, right, as everybody has, and you wouldn't deny that. And there are people who say that. I mean, I was reading a review of your career, and it described you as one of the most maddening actors of your generation, all the talent in the world. And you spent the first two decades of your career squandering it in mostly unwatchable dreck. Now, not everybody would go that far. Having said that, is it because you take risks that that's happened?
That what's happened?
That you have made some duds.
Well, that's part of the reason. Look, you can sit there and have everything lined up, the best script, the best director, the best cast, everything, and you can still make a dud. It's a miracle to make a good movie. But the fact that I've taken risk and done things that I really bet on, the script being elevated when we made it into a movie, and some of them didn't elevate. Some of them underwhelmed. I mean, some of them, the magic that maybe I saw in the script that I took a chance with an independent that I'm like, God, I'm just going to take it. I'm going to roll the dice here. Some of them turned out to be, ooh, boy, we missed that one. Uh-oh, bogey. Missed it. But then also taking some risk on some small things that turned out to be wonderful and my greatest successes. I mean, nobody wanted to make Dallas Buyers Club. No one wanted to make a period piece AIDS drama with, you know, that's for damn sure. And we didn't have the money to make that thing all the way up until 8 days before we shot it. And we still were $2.1 million under the budget we needed. But, you know, Jean-Marc Vallée, the director, cancels the grip department. We don't have one light in the whole movie. We shoot the thing in 25 days and look what you get.
What convinced you that that movie was going to be so good?
I had been attached to that script for years.
Yeah.
And when I first read it, I was like, I understand who this man is, Ron Woodruff, and what he's doing and how he's hustling to fight to survive. And I loved how the script was a non-sentimental take on a tragic subject. I mean, Ron was a businessman. He was trying to make money and he might as well as stay alive and if he could and help other people out as well. But he was trailblazing primarily to stay alive, to do whatever it took for him to stay alive. He was never really, you know, wave the white flag crusader to lead, you know, to lead forward and to have breakthroughs in the medical world for HIV patients. He did have a lot of leadership there and blazed and broke, you know, broke the mold and began a lot of what's going on today and has been since then to better help and medicate people who are sick with HIV. But that wasn't his, like, he wasn't looking to be the crusader. And I remember just appreciating it, feeling it was very human. It was very, very, very human with that false sentimentality. So I attached myself to it. I loved it. But even then, when I had it for 5 years, nobody wanted to make that, especially with Matthew McConaughey in the lead. You know, they were like, I'm not making that movie with rom-com shirtless on the beach McConaughey. No way. but I held on to it, and I was like, it'll have its day. This will have its day. And trust me, many directors came on, loved the script, but didn't want to do it with me and tried to take the script. I said, no, didn't let it go. Many actors who could get it made, who could get it financed, like I could not at the time, tried to take it from me. And I said, absolutely not. And I fought for it. I literally said, if you really think you're going to take this away from me, here's my address. Here I am. Come and meet me. You come and take it. See if you can get it. You ain't. You don't have a chance. And in the artist world, or you know, out there, people go, when they hear someone really have a passion for something, hang on to it. Most of the time they go, okay. All right. No, you keep it. And I held on to it. And then even after I'd come back and done a few movies and was successful coming into the McConaissance, still a period piece AIDS drama? Who wants to finance that? I don't know. We got $4.9 million to make that movie. And the last million we got like a week before shooting. So we were the underdog from the get-go and then ended up making something that really worked. And really stands on its own in a beautiful way and a really well-told story that Jean-Marc put together.
You've got a lot of other stuff going on, of course. One of them is J.K. Living Foundation. Tell me what that is, please.
So we have an after-school foundation, my wife and I. It's in Title I schools. Title I schools are lower-income schools with 50% dropout rates, usually in the harder parts of town where there's a lot of gangs in these areas and some of the schools. Most of the students are on the lunch ticket, a lot of single parent homes. We offer a place, a safe place for these young men and women to go after school twice a week where they set up an exercise goal, meaning, hey, I want to, you know, make the soccer team next year, but I'm not in good enough shape to jog at the quarter of a mile. Well, we're going to help you, you know, get in shape to do that. Or, you know, another girl says, hey, I need to lose 3 pounds so I can fit in my prom dress. Well, we're going to help you meet that goal. We give them nutrition goals. All right. So since your mom spent $45 on 6 burgers and fries last night, and that's what you were going to have again tonight, instead, we're going to take your mom and you to the supermarket. We're going to spend that $45 on some produce, on some rice, maybe a little bit of meat. Same amount of money you're going to spend, but you're going to have a healthier meal and you get to go home and cook it together. Good family time. Third, community service. Every student has to do community service within their community. And that gives them accountability, meaning it's not, this is not a free ride, not a free ticket. We're not just giving you these things. You have to do these. And it gives the kids some ownership because they have to do some work too. And then finally, which is sort of I think the original part of our foundation is we're big on gratitude, meaning we have a gratitude circle at the end of every curriculum where the kids sit around and out loud in a circle share something in their life that they are thankful for. And that's really been sort of the most original part of our curriculum, because so many of these children come up and go, I love the gratitude circle because I'm hearing people, friends of mine, say thank you for things in their lives that I have in my life, but I've always taken for granted and never even been thankful for. And our belief is that the more you're thankful for in your life, the more you're going to create in your life to be thankful for.
I read an account by Camilla of how where the money came from for the JK Living Foundation, and it was something to do with you guys being offered an obscene amount of money for a photo of your first child. Is that right?
That's true.
How much were you offered?
Oh, I'm not going to say how much we were offered, but it was a very, very nice chunk of change. And, you know, we were like, okay, this is a way to use, you know, instead of trying to hide out from the paparazzi all day, every day, and there's six cars sitting out front of our house 24/7, let's just do a deal with this publication that just offered this huge amount of money. Let's do a real nice photo shoot with her and I and our newborn son, Levi, and that money will kick off, that'll create our foundation. And then all the paparazzi will leave because the first photos are good and they're already out. So it was a twofold plan, and it worked.
It's been a rough year, 2020, for everybody, really. What are you anticipating? What are you looking forward to next year?
It's going to be a 20-year rebuild around the world. I mean, let's see if we just get on the other side of this. Even if we just get on the other side of COVID, this has been a year that has really shaken our floor as a people, as a species. I think it's also a year where we are going to be able to look back on, I don't know when, not too soon, I don't think, but that we will be able to look back on and go, oh, you know what, that actually, there were some green lights in that year, or that was the beginning, that red light year of 2020. Shook us so much and brought us down to our barest necessities that we ever had in there, and we rebuilt out of that. Can we evolve out of this? That's what I look forward to, but I know that's a long rebuild, and we're going to have patience and talk about resilience. We need it now, and we're going to have maintain it for quite some time, because the only way out of this is we have to build our way out of this. And hopefully we're going to be able to build better people, better individuals out of this.
Matthew McConaughey, his book, which is not a hard read, it's a good thing, Green Lights, it's called.